podcast listeners. Welcome back to the Psychology of Video Games podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Madigan. Now, this is the last podcast for 2017. It's been a pretty great year for Psychology of Games, the website, the podcast, and everything else that I've been doing. I wrote a bunch of articles, did a bunch of new podcasts where I got to talk to some great new guests and have some returning guests come back. My book, Getting Gamers, was apparently picked up by a couple of psychology and or game design college courses and is being used for that I recently found out. So that's pretty cool. And also over the course of the year, got to talk to some cool people in the press. And I even got to do a live talk with a group of middle school children about psychology and video games and the effects that games have on kids and other people. So that was pretty cool. Can mark that one off my bucket list. I also had the podcast moved over to Blog Talk Radio by invitation. So that's pretty cool. I also had a lot of great support from people on my Patreon. I appreciate every one of you that does that and that kicks in a dollar or three my way. It has helped out a lot over the year, especially when the laptop that I normally use to record these podcasts suddenly died and I had to go get a new one. It was great having that support. Things have been busy with me, both for the psychology of game stuff and just in other parts of my life and my work. And as always, the holidays. This time of year is pretty busy. So given that, what I put together for this episode of the podcast is kind of like a clip show. So it's the audio versions of 12 articles that I've written for the website over the last several months. You may have heard these, may have read them. If you're a Patreon supporter, you get them in audio format every month. But you may enjoy listening to them again. And if you are new to the website and to the podcast, you probably never heard these unless you've gone digging through the archives. So I hope you enjoy them, and I will see you next episode. Kisses, anticipation, and the lost art of identifying. Used to be when you looted a chest and found a magic weapon in a game, you had to take it back to town to get it identified. You can't see this, but I'm pulling my pants up to my armpits and waving my cane around as I say that. But it's true, and I remember often feeling a great sense of anticipation as I carried something around with me for a few minutes or even hours before I could find out what it was and use it. It's something I think that's largely been lost in modern video games, where everything is identified either immediately or with just a couple of clicks. I think something may have gotten lost. To understand why, let's talk about sucking face with famous people. And by that, I mean let's talk about a study by economist George Lowenstein. In that study, Lowenstein was interested in how anticipation affected how much people valued something that they would get in the future. Among other things, he asked subjects how much they would pay to, quote, obtain a kiss from a movie star of your choice, end quote. Hey, 1987 was a comparatively chaste time. No doubt the survey would have been more lewd today. Conditions were varied, though, so that the subjects anticipated getting the smooch either immediately or after a wait of a day or 2 days, a year, or 10 years. You might think that people were willing to pay the most to get the kiss immediately. Or maybe give me a day to brush my teeth and put on a clean shirt. Why wait longer? But it turned out that subjects were willing to pay the most for a kiss that was going to be 3 whole days in coming. Anticipation of pleasure, it turns out, has value. This is why I wonder if the lost art of identifying loot in video games is causing us to miss out on some of the pleasure from anticipation. Would we get more net pleasure out of waiting to see what we got and a chance to use it? What about level caps and equipment? Those always felt annoying to me, but maybe I'm not being optimistic enough and maybe I'm looking at it wrong. Maybe the awesome sword or the spiffy shield that I won't be able to use until I'm level 18 have some value when I'm level 16. Lowenstein notes that you can make this anticipation effect stronger by helping people vividly imagine what's coming. Games that let you preview what cosmetic items will look like or how new equipment will behave could accomplish this easily. You don't have to imagine it, and you can see it right there. It also makes me think of the progress bars for developing new technologies in Metal Gear Solid 5. In that game, you start research projects that are completed in real time, not game time. You literally have to wait for a certain number of hours for a progress bar to fill up before a new shotgun or rocket launcher or whatever is available. Does waiting for that stuff increase the amount of pleasure we get from it? I may think that I'd rather have it right away, but as a human brain piloting a sack of meat and bones, I'm a notoriously bad judge of such things. Given the above study, I have to think, maybe I'd be happier if I waited. In Lowenstein's study, the kiss and other anticipations he experimented with, a painful shock or receiving or losing money, for example, were experiences that came and went pretty quickly. You don't keep a kiss after you get it. It's an experience, not a possession. Lowenstein remarks that, quote, delaying is more likely when consumption is fleeting, end quote. So maybe in the case of video games, the value of anticipation would be greatest when the prize is also fleeting. Like taking place in a tournament, or playing alongside a celebrity YouTube or Twitch streamer, or receiving consumable boosters, or playing in a closed beta. Just some fun things to experiment with, though, if you're a game designer. Dark Souls and getting into a good mindset. Dark Souls helped me be a better parent the other day. I was chatting with my daughter in the car. Opportunities for uninterrupted time alone to talk to her are rare, since I usually want everybody to just leave me alone so I can sit in my room and play video games. So I took it. We'd recently signed up my daughter for a summer swim team, which would start its practices soon. I asked her if she was looking forward to it, and she said no. I looked into the rearview mirror. Why not? You were into it last summer. I don't know, she said, shrugging and looking away. Getting up to practice sucks, and the competitions are kind of intense. Further probing revealed that by intense, she meant intimidating, and by sucks, she meant, well, sucks. She's right on all counts, no doubt. The swim meets are noisy and demanding competitions where she goes up against others who are often better than her. But I thought getting excited about competitive swimming would be good for her for various reasons, so I started to say, well, you're really good at it, which is true. But then I thought of two things that made me reconsider those particular words. The first was Dark Souls 3, which I had been fighting my way through at the time. If you don't know, the Dark Souls series is difficult by most standards, but I think most of that reputation is earned by virtue of brutally punishing sloppy players who don't pay attention. It's true that the Souls games require a baseline of manual dexterity and game system literacy, but if you persist at them and learn how things work, where enemies lurk, and exactly how to engage with the in-game dangers, you can persist and win. Nobody's naturally talented at Dark Souls. Nobody flies through on their first try if they're totally new to the game. Failure is an opportunity to learn, an opportunity to persist, and an opportunity to, as they say, get good. The second thing that made me reconsider the words, well, you're really good at it, to my daughter, was a book I had finished reading recently. It's called Mindset, The New Psychology of Success by Carol Dweck. Now, that title sounds a little self-helpy, and it is so in some places, but it's also rooted in some real research that Dweck has done on what she calls fixed and growth mindsets. Consider how much you agree with these questions from Dweck's research. 1. You are a certain kind of person, and there is not much that can be done to really change that. 2. No matter what kind of person you are, you can always change substantially. 3. You can do things differently, but important parts of you can't really be changed. 4. You can always change basic things about the kind of person you are. Agreeing with questions 1 and 3 indicates more of a fixed mindset. Agreeing with questions 2 and 4 indicates a growth mindset. Now, these are just a few of the items from the research used for purposes of illustration, but you get the idea. These mindsets are attitudes and beliefs that govern how people conceptualize success and how they deal with failure. People who are naturally talented athletes or academics, for example, tend to have fixed mindsets. They think that they have a given amount of talent that sets them apart. They may be right, but Dweck's book argues that this also may fix them in place, and that people with such a mindset not only don't try to grow their skills, they avoid situations that are beyond them so that failure doesn't damage their self-esteem. This is in contrast to people with growth mindsets who may not have heaps of raw talent, but they do believe that they can improve. They also aren't averse to failing in order to improve. People of this type are more likely to see screwing up as a chance to learn how to improve, and they're less embarrassed and frustrated by challenges that are, at the moment, beyond their ability. Those with a growth mindset, Dweck argues, are more likely to be successful, happy, and productive, no matter where their reserve of raw talent tops out. This highlights something I've thought about for a long time about video games. Whenever somebody bags on them as a waste of time, I come back to the idea that most video games teach you what I now know is a growth mindset. Games let you fail. They expect you to fail. Dark Souls 3 threw me up against Eidyx Gundyr, a difficult boss fight, during the tutorial. I died to him 15 or more times, but I persisted and eventually figured out how to time my evasions and bait him into overextending himself so I could safely counterattack. If you're the kind of person who thinks you're really good at video games and can just pick up any title and beat it, if you're the kind of person who has a fixed mindset like that, then you're probably going to be pissed off at Dark Souls. Maybe you'll call it poorly designed and throw down the controller without ever making it through the tutorial area. But I'm not good at Dark Souls because I've got quick reflexes and a sense of timing that lets me fly through it on the first exposure. I'm good at Dark Souls games because I know they expect a growth mindset out of me and I give it to them. I pay attention, I learn, I keep at it until I get the encounters down. This is why I bit my tongue before saying, "Well, you're really good at swimming," when my daughter expressed doubts about staying on the swim team. Instead, I said, "Well, you've improved a lot since you started." Then I told her about Eidyx Gundyr. Practice sessions started a couple of weeks ago, and her first swim meet is in a few days. She's a gamer, so she gets it. Why do badges, trophies, and achievements work? At this point in human history, we can pretty much take it for granted that badges, trophies, achievements, and similar awards are baked into most gaming systems. Achievement unlocked is a punchline that can be swapped into any situation where you get something for doing what you, presumably, were already going to do. They're also part of the holy trinity of points, badges, leaderboards, of gamification, which applies game systems to non-gaming activities like working, shopping, or philanthropy. But do they work? That is, does rewarding or promising to reward player behaviors with achievements, trophies, and badges actually get people to engage in those behaviors more? Does it get them to play the game more? Has anyone actually ever studied that? Well, yeah, sorta. I recently read an article in the journal Computers and Human Behavior by Juho Harami, entitled "Do Badges Increase User Activity? A Field Experiment on the Effects of Gamification." In it, the author worked with the people behind ShareTribe.com, a website that helps users find others to whom they can rent, sell, or share things like products, services, or physical spaces. ShareTribe is very community-oriented, so it really wants users who log in regularly, participate in markets, and provide important information to other users. So the researchers wanted to see if adding achievements in the form of badges displayed on user profiles and elsewhere would help increase the kinds of user activities that they wanted. To do that, he conducted a field study of almost 3,000 actual website users. It was also longitudinal. About half the data covered users who registered up to 1 year before the badges were added to the site, while the rest covered those registered after badges were added. So, to cut straight to the chase, Hamari did indeed find that adding badges to the website had the intended effects. It increased the likelihood that any given user would use the website to, quote, post trade proposals, carry out transactions, comments on proposals, and generally use the service in a more active way, end quote. That's cool, or disconcerting, depending on your perspective. But the part of the article I really found most interesting wasn't the results. It was a section discussing theoretical underpinnings of badges and reasons why they might work. These reasons seem completely applicable to video games. So the 8 potential reasons why badges, achievements, and trophies might work in games are: 1. They anchor our performance expectations higher. 2. Having goals increases our self-efficacy. 3. Completing goals leads to satisfaction. 4. They create goal commitment. 5. They act as guidance mechanics and provide feedback. 6. They facilitate psychological flow through feedback. 7. They trigger social proof. And 8. They trigger motivating social comparisons. So let's briefly drill down into each one of those. 1. Achievements anchor our expectations. The anchoring effect happens when a high or low number out of the gate causes us to fixate on it and use it as a point of reference for considering how high or low other values are. Think of the classic lowball offer in negotiating for the price of a car. A low number as the opening offer causes the seller to focus on that number instead of whatever price they previously had in mind. This often results in a lower final price paid. Achievements that communicate high scores and other numbers might anchor a player's expectations about what is a reasonable score, or whatever, to shoot for. Even if they try to adjust their expectations down, they won't be as low as if there were no anchor set by the achievements. Which leads us to 2. Achievements increase self-efficacy. Hearing that a goal, as set by an achievement, is possible for us and people like us makes it more likely that we'll think we're capable of reaching it. This is a concept in psychology called self-efficacy, belief in our own efficacy or ability to do something if we try. This is probably true to the extent that we think a goal is reasonable, as opposed to ridiculously difficult. 3. Earning achievements is satisfying. As Hamari notes based on previous research about goals, the completion of goals leads to increased satisfaction, which in turn leads to increased performance within the same activities. If we reach a goal and enjoy the boost in self-efficacy and confidence that it creates, that feels good. And since we like doing things that make us feel good, we're more likely to pursue similar achievements in the future to get the same reward. 4. Starting progress towards achievements creates commitment. When goals are specified in very specific terms explaining what you have to do and how many times you have to do it in order to reach them, it increases the chances that people will reach them. Achievements that specify kill 3,000 zombies are much more likely to lock players in to shotgun the undead more than just general instructions to kill zombies until the credits roll. I'll also note that if you make players feel that they have already begun progress towards an achievement by the time you present it to them, you'll increase their commitment to reaching it even more. 5. Achievements guide players and provide feedback. Not to overstate the obvious, but achievements often confer information about what is expected of players in the game. An achievement unlocked by finding all the secret areas or maximizing an NPC's affinity rating tells the player that, yeah, there are secrets to be found, and the NPC affinity mechanic does exist. Furthermore, if the achievement system is set up to indicate progress towards these goals, it tells players how much the game's possibility space they have explored. 6. Achievements facilitate psychological flow. Psychological flow is a state of mind characterized by engagement with an activity that's the sweet spot between effort and ability. We generally want flow and players who are motivated to pursue it. Getting feedback on how well you're doing on a task, or if you're doing it at all, and good, accurate, and timely feedback is critical to achieving flow. To the extent that achievements facilitate this kind of feedback, and thus psychological flow, they will be motivating. 7. Achievements trigger social proof. Social proof is a term often applied to situations where we look to the opinions and actions of those around us in order to answer questions or form opinions. It's so powerful that it can cause us to disbelieve our own senses. It can also cause us to pursue activities if we think that other people are also engaging in those activities or pursuing those goals. Thus, if an achievement system tells us that everyone is completing a certain side quest or playing with a certain loadout, social proof will lead us to believe that that's not only possible, but it is in fact normal for all players to do the same. Because, as psychologist Robert Cialdini notes, quote, we view a behavior as correct in a given situation to the degree that we see others performing it, end quote. 8. Achievements trigger social comparisons. Leon Festinger's social comparison theory holds that we want objective information about our performance, and lacking that information, or a suitable context in which to evaluate it, we will seek to compare ourselves to meaningful others. Viewing the achievements and badges earned by other players is a convenient way to do this sort of benchmarking. If I see you earned an achievement, I am also motivated to try to the degree that I think you and I are similar on attributes and skills necessary to do so. So again, credit goes to Juho Harami for summarizing the points above. I hope more people take on the task of doing targeted research to expand our knowledge of how and when each of these factors works in practice. Twitching, cheering, and dirty laundry. Twitch TV, as most of you probably know, is a website where you can go to watch people stream videos of themselves playing games. It's kind of a big deal. Twitch has long allowed donations and subscriptions as a means of financial support for specific streamers. Recently, though, they added another support option in the form of cheers that allow you to flick small amounts of money at streamers according to your whims and fancies. Here's how it works. You go to the Twitch website and purchase bits that are stored in your account. Getting 100 bits currently costs $1.40, while 25,000 bits costs $308. Best value. During a stream, you can type cheer 50 or Cheer 100 to donate 50 or 100 bits to the streamer, which is accompanied by a fancy little emote in the chat. These bits eventually get converted into real money for the streamer. This is cool on the face of it because it's great to have more options to support streamers that you like, so thumbs up. But there are some psychological tricks that Twitch has baked into the whole bit cheer system that you may want to know about. There are at least two reasons why this system might make you pay more than you realize or intend to. The first is related to the fact that you have to buy bits in bulk ahead of time and then spend them piecemeal. Back in 1998, Drazen Prelec and George Lowenstein published an important paper where they proposed a theory about how people experience the displeasure of paying for something. Paying money for something causes displeasure or pain. If our expected pleasure from the purchase outweighs the pain, then no problem. But if it doesn't, then we're less likely to make the purchase. One way that retailers have figured out how to reduce the perceived pain of a purchase is to disconnect thoughts about the payment from thoughts about the purchase. Gift cards, credit cards, refillable store cards, these all place a temporal buffer between the pleasure of the thing bought and the pain of the purchase. The pain has already taken place, so when the time comes to spend the credit you bought, you don't experience it and are thus more likely to spend more. Research shows that we tend to think of it as a separate transaction that causes less mental pleasure and perceptions of cost. For example, in one clever study, a researcher from the University of Toronto spied on people who were going to wash their clothes at a public laundromat. If you're feeling the bite of every quarter fed into the washing machine, a good way to reduce the cost is to combine loads of dark and light clothes so that you pay for fewer loads. If you're less concerned with the cost, you might opt to take better care of your clothes and wash the lights and darks separately. The clever part of the experiment was that the researcher timed it so that about half of the people observed visited before the laundromat moved from coin-operated machines to a system that required customers to buy several dollars worth of credit at a time on a refillable card. Relative to those who paid cash every time they did a load, those who used the prepaid card tended to do more loads of wash and pay more as a result, because the payment for the credit card was decoupled from the purchase of laundry loads. Same thing with purchasing Twitch's bits in bulk. The second psychological phenomenon at work in the Twitch bits cheer system is called transparency. Consumer psychologists have long known that another way to reduce the pain of purchase is to make it more difficult for you to think about exactly how much you're paying. That is, to make the transaction less transparent. Cash is highly transparent in that you know exactly how much of it you're giving up in the transaction. Checks and credit are less transparent because we don't tend to think as much about the money they represent and we're likely to spend more. But things like in-game currency are the least transparent of all. Even setting aside the temporal decoupling of the cost with the purchase, how much did those 20 bits that you just gave to the streamer cost you? Well, let's see, you paid $7 for 500 bits, there's 100 cents to the dollar, so if I divide 500 by 700, or wait, is it 700 by 500? You know what, forget it. Even if the mental effort required to do the math isn't large, it's well known that our minds prefer to avoid it. This is one big benefit for Twitch of not having a simple 1 bit equal 1 cent exchange rate. So by all means, support your favorite streamers and your favorite bloggers if you're able to and if you think they deserve it. But do it on your own terms. The overjustification effect and game achievements. Imagine it's the 1960s. Got it? Okay. Hey, you look good in those clothes, actually. Now, further imagine that you're a student at Carnegie Mellon University participating in a psychology experiment. The researcher presents you with a small pile of plastic shapes that can be fitted together to make bigger shapes. He then shows you drawings of such forms and asks you to recreate them. The first one looks like a duck. The experimenter says he's interested in how many puzzles you can solve within 13-minute chunks of time. Around the middle of the session, the experimenter excuses himself from the room, saying he'll be back in a few minutes, and you're free to amuse yourself however you like. You notice that there's a stack of magazines on the table next to you that includes, weirdly enough, a copy of Playboy magazine. There are also still the puzzle pieces and drawings. What do you do? Specifically, how much time do you continue to spend working on the shape puzzles until the experiment resumes? Well, it turns out that the answer to that depends on whether or not you are being paid to make the shapes. The experimenters found that when they did not offer payment, subjects spent on average about 248 seconds, or a little over 4 minutes, of their unsupervised time to voluntarily keep working on the puzzles. We can assume that their motivations for solving the puzzles were intrinsic. They were internal to the person and for the sake of the activity itself. Maybe the subjects found the puzzles somewhat fun or interesting. Then, the experimenter told some of the subjects that they would be paid $1 for every puzzle that they solved correctly. This introduced an extrinsic motivator. The cash was external to the mind of the person doing the task. This time, during their unsupervised time, subjects spent an average of 313 seconds, well over 5 minutes, solving the puzzles. Hey, that's a 26% increase. Now, though, the kicker. For the final puzzle-solving session, subjects were told that there was no more money to be had, so the $1 per puzzle reward was retracted. Subjects' average free time on the puzzles plummeted to 198 seconds, not much more than 3 minutes. That's 20% lower than the 248 seconds spent before cash payments were even brought into the conversation. Here's the TLDR version. 1. People were relatively happy to solve puzzles for free because of intrinsic motivators. 2. Adding an external motivator, cash payments, increased how many puzzles they solved. Yay! Though subsequently taking the extrinsic motivator away tanked their motivation and reduced their performance to less than it was originally. Boo! Offering an external reward and then taking it away is sometimes worse than never offering it in the first place. It's something psychologists call the overjustification effect, and it has been found in various other studies as well. What's more, I think it happens sometimes in video games. Take achievements, trophies, and badges, for example. There are generally considered to be an external motivator. Unlocking an achievement on Steam or Xbox is a little reward that's generally independent of the game, even if you had to do something inside the game to get it. So are systems like gamer scores or percentages of trophies unlocked. I asked Michael Hannes, a researcher and assistant professor at the University of Nebraska, if this was a reasonable stance to take, and here's what he said. Quote, "It's pretty safe to say that achievements and trophies are extrinsic motivators. They're coming from outside of you. The game designer is making these, you're playing the game, and the game is giving them to you in terms of goals. And the rewards themselves are extrinsically motivating. If you do this thing, you'll go and achieve this outside reward given to you by someone else." End quote. Whether an external reward will trigger the overjustification effect depends on a few things. The person must be intrinsically motivated to start with. Then she must start receiving an external reward that gradually takes center stage in her mind. It also helps if the external reward comes as a surprise, at least at first. Another factor that's important is whether the external motivator is seen as controlling and even manipulative rather than simply informational. It matters if a game tells you, hey, you aren't playing right if you don't aim for this achievement. That's controlling, and it hurts intrinsic motivation. But if the game tells you, hey, you've been doing your thing and you earned this achievement as a result, that's informational and should increase intrinsic motivation. Hannes puts it this way, quote, "The way that researchers talk about rewards is that they're broken up into two things to think about. Are you controlling me? Are you telling me what to do? Or are they supporting me and giving information that says, hey, what you've been doing is a good job. It's along the lines of what you already wanted to do internally for your own reasons." So how you see the reward in any given moment depends on whether you take that as internal or external motivator. End quote. The way that a game constructs and presents its achievements could have a big impact on whether they actually help or harm a player's motivation to keep engaging with the game. Because, like the subject of the study above, when the extrinsic motivator goes away because you got that achievement or you beat the main questline, a player's motivation to keep experimenting and noodling with the game, things they love to do in the beginning, may shrivel up when there's no more external rewards to go. Trophies and achievements may actually hurt in the long run. While this has been studied extensively in other contexts, it hasn't really been studied enough in the context of games or gamification. But it seems a very reasonable hypothesis to put to the test, given how ubiquitous achievements, trophies, and badges are in video games. Do non-player characters count as an audience? I've written before about the effects of having an audience when we play games. Research on having others watch you perform a task goes way back to the 1800s, when researchers timed how quickly children would reel fishing lines in when they were watching other kids doing it nearby. Similar results were found for cyclists pedaling alone or alongside others. There's too much research on this topic to get into here, but the short version of one widely cited theory is that when you think you have an audience, you use mental resources thinking about them and how they may be reacting to what you're doing. If you're doing something easy, this isn't a problem. You've probably got mental resources to spare, and having an audience will probably motivate you to try harder on the task and thus perform better. But if you're doing something difficult and novel, that takes more mental juice that you may not have to spare for thinking about an audience. As a result, having an audience for difficult tasks hurts performance. Taken as a whole, this is often called the audience effect. But a paper that I recently saw presented at the 2016 KaiPlay conference put an interesting spin on this. Do NPCs in a game ever count as an audience? Do we think of them in that way enough to trigger the audience effect? There's actually some precedence for thinking so. In one 2008 study, researchers actually found that the obnoxious little paperclip helper Clippy from Microsoft Word could be seen as judgy and condescending enough to impede performance on a difficult typing task. The KaiPlay paper is entitled The Influence of Virtual Agents on Player Experiences and Performance. In it, the researchers created a simple game where you pilot a spaceship through an asteroid field, avoiding or blasting obstacles and scooping up items. Because they wanted to test the effects of spatial presence, that is, feeling like you're actually there in the game world, on the audience effect, they had both a virtual reality version of the game played with an Oculus Rift headset and a less fancy version played on a monitor. To test whether an NPC could trigger the audience effect, the researchers created a cutesy little robot character that would be either present or not in the heads-up display, depending on what experimental condition a given player was in. So for those of you into experimental design jargon, they had a 2, VR or non-VR, by 2, NPC audience or no NPC audience, design. They looked at players' game scores under various conditions. What they found that was under conditions of high spatial awareness and immersion, that is, when playing with virtual reality version of the game, players did worse. Performance was significantly worse if the agent was present, they write, indicating an inhibition effect. In a lot of ways, this was a preliminary study, but it raises some interesting questions that can be addressed by more research. Do people attend to NPCs more when playing in virtual reality because they're more immersed and feel more spatial presence? Does dealing with all that VR tax their mental reserves such that a significant bite's taken out of the remainder by the otherwise innocuous little robot friend? In a way, this study could be interpreted as supporting the idea of an audience effect as described in other studies. I'm also curious about whether or not the effects would be stronger if the NPC were something more than a mostly passive little robot sitting on the periphery of the screen. What if it said stuff about your performance? What if it cheered or sighed in exasperation while you played? What if the NPC were someone the game had cemented as more important to the narrative and with whom you had formed a kind of affinity or at least familiarity? Would this exacerbate the NPC audience effect even more? Science should find out. Go get at it, science. Overjustified Overwatch. I'll tell ya, sometimes I write an article about some concept and try my best to come up with a great illustration from a current video game to keep things current. And then, immediately after I hit publish, the perfect example of it shows up in the news or in some new game that I'm playing. It happened again. A few weeks ago, I wrote about the overjustification effect and then talked to my podcast about it. See the thingamabob below for links to both of those, but in case they're not fresh in your memory, I'll recap real quick. The overjustification effect is when somebody offers an extrinsic reward, like money or an in-game currency, for a task that people were initially just doing for the fun of it, like playing a video game. Then, after a while, they take the reward away. When they do that, it tends to hurt people's motivation for doing the task, playing a video game, for example, because they had shifted their focus towards that external reward as their main motivation for doing it. Along those lines, the competitive online shooter Overwatch recently released a big patch. Among the additions was an arcade mode that let you try out a bunch of different rule sets, such as brawls, random character selects, and dueling. Some of these are really fun modes. I particularly like the 3v3 mode, where you fight for the best of 3 rounds with another trio of players without the benefits of respawns or health packs. It's great! Also included in the arcade mode is the ability to unlock bonus loot crates. Get 3 wins in any arcade mode, and you get a loot box. These boxes are valuable to players because they contain random cosmetic items and in-game currency. Normally, the only way to get one is to grind out experience points by playing full matches until you level up. Upon seeing they were giving away loot boxes for the arcade mode, I was excited and played game after game of the 3v3 elimination mode to get my bonus boxes. However, there was a catch. Blizzard capped the number of loot boxes you could get in this way at 3 every 5 days. After you get those 3, you can still enjoy all the arcade modes you want, but you stop earning those bonus loot boxes for 5 days. So what happened after I got my 3 bonus loot boxes in the arcade? I switched back to the regular objective mode matches and quick play. Because I had stopped earning the extrinsic reward of loot boxes and had focused on that as my motivation for playing in the arcade, thus falling prey to the overjustification. Sometimes, even knowing about this stuff doesn't insulate you from it. Deliberate practice and getting good. I remember being pretty good at the arcade version of Street Fighter 2 when it first came out. I had a really solid Guile that I played in an unconventionally aggressive style, and pretty good Blanka. I could beat most of the people at the 2 arcades that I went to, and I thought I had mastered the game. Then, one day, this guy I had never seen before came in and totally wrecked me. And he did it with multiple characters as I kept feeding quarters into the machine. He had an impossible-to-escape fireball traps, wake-up dragon punches, impeccable zoning, and more. It wasn't even close. He was not only better at this game than anyone I'd ever encountered, he was better than I thought was even possible. This was well before YouTube, Twitch, or any other kind of video on the internet, so I had never had a chance to see how good somebody could get at a video game outside of Urban Legends or people blustering on Usenet. Now, the growing popularity of streaming and esports means that we can easily see what truly godlike, top-tier players look like. People who are so quick, so practiced, and who appear to do amazing things so effortlessly. They seem to be as far removed from the rest of us players as professional athletes or concert violinists are from my cat. He can't even hold a violin properly. For me, this begs the question, how do you get that good at video games? Looking at the Bobby Fischers, Chess Guy, Yo-Yo Ma's, Cello Dude, and Serena Williams's, Tennis Lady, of the world, it's tempting to assume that gaming superstars are similarly gifted with some rare kink in their DNA that sets them apart from other mortals. They just have a natural affinity that gets them most of the way there. The rest is presumably having the right gaming mouse and snacks. But I'm not so sure. I suspect it has a lot to do with how they practice the games, which we probably don't fully understand yet. This is largely because I recently read the book Peak, Secrets of the New Science of Expertise by Anders Ericsson and Robert Poole. Ericsson in particular has done a lot of research on how people practice in order to master a skill. Super author Malcolm Gladwell popularized the work of Ericsson and his collaborators in the book Outliers, where Gladwell discussed what he called the 10,000-hour rule. The idea is that it takes about that many hours of practice to become a master at something. Chess, violin, basketball free throws, CS dust, whatever. Ericsson pushes back against this oversimplification in his book Peak, saying that the number of hours is far less important than the way in which people practice a skill. Instead of using a stopwatch or a stop calendar to chart our path to mastery, Ericsson calls for what he calls deliberate practice. This isn't just practicing a skill by doing it over and over again. I mean, it is that, but it's also more. The authors summarize the principles of deliberate practice thusly. 1. It develops skills that other people have already figured out how to do and for which training methods have already been figured out. 2. It happens outside of the trainee's comfort zone. 3. It relies on well-defined specific goals and targets, very specific things for improvement. For example, in basketball, think making 90% of free throws versus making more shots. 4. It requires full focus and attention. No zoning out or practicing on autopilot, even if things are repetitive and boring. You gotta pay attention to what you're doing. 5, it involves getting accurate feedback and deliberately acting on it. 6, it creates and relies on accurate mental representations or mental models of what the trainee is doing. 7, it focuses on improving skills in a step-by-step approach. It focuses on incremental improvements. The others go on to describe how this can not only apply to sports, music, and chess, but also to other areas of life and work. And, I think, video games. It would be fascinating to levy this kind of deliberate training program at getting better at games. Not just playing games, but playing them deliberately in very specific ways so as to get better. It would, of course, be tricky and maybe not a perfect fit to the ideal deliberate practice regimen. Team-based games like League of Legends could be hard to practice deliberately because they rely so much on cooperation and synergy with teammates. But I could easily imagine a non-team game like StarCraft where players use mods or custom maps to drill through optimal build orders or micromanaging units and casting just right. And then watching replays, which are conveniently recorded by the game, to refine their mental model of what's happening in the game and extracting feedback from their actions. One of the things that Erickson and Poole emphasize is having access to a really good coach that's appropriate to your level of skill. Beginners can benefit from just about any kind of coaching. But as you progress, you need somebody who knows more and can customize training activities to correct for subtle mistakes. Like Olympic athletes who retire to coach a new generation of Olympians, I wonder if there's a market for aging esports stars to take up coaching gigs, or to charge by the hour to review recordings of matches and assign deliberate practice drills. I mean, forget esports, that's already old news. E-coaches are where it's probably going to be at. The Zagarnik Effect and Quest Logs. For a few months at the end of 2016, I was between full-time jobs. After lining up a new job to start in January, I found myself in December with a lot of free time, so I decided to check out what was going on with Diablo 3's season events, since I had never participated in one of those before. During that, I found myself contemplating what waiters in the 1920s Venetian restaurant scene and today's average Diablo 3 fan have in common. It's not the spatula or the bratwurst. It's that they both tend to remember things that they have yet to finish. Sometime during the 1920s, Russian psychologist Bulma Zagarnik was sitting in an Austrian restaurant, or maybe it was German, accounts differ, when she noticed something peculiar. Waiters displayed an unusual ability to remember complex orders while they were being filled, allowing them to deliver the right combination of food to the right tables. But oddly, that information vanished from memory as soon as the eats were put in place. It didn't seem to have much to do with sustained mental effort or chanting the incomplete orders under their breath and to hold them in short-term memory. Instead, the orders that hadn't yet been filled just seemed to nag at the waiters' minds until they were checked off as complete. Back in her lab, Zagarnik pursued this idea and ran some experiments. These involved the completion of various tasks and puzzles. Some of the subjects performing the tasks were interrupted, then everyone was asked to describe what tasks they had done. Like the waiters remembering what orders still needed to go to what tables, subjects were far more likely to recall the tasks they had started but hadn't completed. The Zagarnik effect subsequently entered the psychology lexicon to describe how we tend to find it easier to recall a task and the details surrounding it when we feel like we have begun to undertake it but have not yet completed it. Apparently, we as humans don't like it when we begin something and don't finish it, and such circumstances create an internal tension and preoccupation with the task. Completing the task provides closure, releases the tension, and, not to put too fine a technical point on it, creates goody-feely type feels. And we see this all the time in video games, particularly role-playing games where in-game journals get crammed full of unfinished quests, errands, and tasks. Ever wring your hands over a huge list of incomplete quests or feel hesitant to progress the main quest until all those little side missions are checked off? To see the effect in action next time you play an RPG, try at the end of your gaming session to recall as many open quests as you can, and then try to recall as many completed quests as you can. And MMOs like World of Warcraft are the worst with this stuff, as anyone who has collected 13 of 14 Gore Tusk Livers can attest. Once we begin one of those tasks, they hang around in the back of our mind and are much easier to recall than our completed tasks. Researchers Scott Rigby and Richard Ryan specifically call out the Zagarnik effect in their book Glued to Games, How Video Games Draw Us In and Hold Us Spellbound. Quote, MMOs are designed so that your list of tasks is never done. No sooner do you complete one than two more pop up to take its place. Like a digital game of whack-a-mole, accomplishments only bring more unfinished business. As soon as you finish or turn in a quest, you are immediately offered another one with an even bigger reward. Or perhaps completion of one unlocks the opportunity to receive many new quests at once. Quests are often linked together in a series that helps move the story along, but never provide much closure. If I need to find 12 jewels to complete my quest, I will not stop at 11. End quote. This all became much more concrete for me last December when I tried to complete Diablo 3's Season 8. The game's season let you start with a fresh level 1 character and then give you a sprawling checklist of tasks to complete. Things like finish a level 70 Nephilim Rift on Torment 5 difficulty, or buy a legendary item from Kadala, or level 3 legendary gems to level 45. It seems to me that the entire point of playing the season was to complete these checklists, and the ones that stumped me were constantly on my mind. We also see this happen in empire-building games like SimCity or Civilization. The just one more turn effect is a direct result of the Zagarnik effect, since that one more turn is almost always in the service of completing some structure, upgrade, technology, or conquest. And researchers have continued to study the Zagarnik effect and refine models associated with it. Some research, for example, has found that people overestimate how long they spend on interrupted tasks, even when the time spent was the same as completed tasks, probably compounded by the availability heuristic, which causes us to overestimate how big or frequent something is based on how easy it is to recall it from memory. Other researchers have noted how the Zagarnik effect isn't completely reliable and have explored moderating factors like how motivated people are to do the task, the nature of the interruption, or the task difficulty. But regardless of whether the effect shows up every time a task is interrupted, it does often happen. The next time you find yourself thinking, just two more turns until this research is complete, or I just need to kill these trolls and make this quest entry go away, remember Bulma Zagarnik and her waiters filling orders for hot dogs and waffles. Or whatever. I don't know what they eat in Austria. The consistency of automatic helping in video games. Recently, I've been reading Robert Cialdini's new book about psychological tricks of persuasion called Pre-Suasion, A Revolutionary Way to Influence and Persuade. One of the major psychological levers of persuasion that Cialdini discusses is the principle of consistency. We feel pressure to act in ways that are consistent with our reputation, stated opinions, or past behavior. It sounds simple, but it can be very powerful. Consider one study where researchers called people on the phone to ask them if they intended to vote in an upcoming election. Just about everybody said yes. This isn't surprising, given that people don't generally want to say that they plan on shirking such a civic duty. But what was surprising is that when the researchers went back to the voting polls to verify such claims, they found that the subjects who said they were going to vote actually did so more often than those in a control group, because they wanted to be consistent with their stated intentions and behaviors. It's a trick that I saw being used frequently in the 2016 U.S. presidential election as well. Hillary Clinton's party, for example, directed voters to IWillVote.com. The website not only provided information on how to vote and how to register, but asked them to click on a button labeled Confirm Where I Will Vote, which can be read, consciously or not, as a pledge to get out there and cast a ballot. Other research has shown that honesty can be increased by simply moving the part of the tax form where a user signs his or her name so that it's next to a statement along the lines of, I promise that all the information I gave here is true. Moving the signature line from the bottom of the form, where users encounter it after they have filled out the form, to the top, where they encounter it before filling anything out, increase their honesty. Even if you're exhibiting consistency only to yourself, the effect is still there. Or here, maybe you're a fan of horse racing, and who isn't? Consider this excerpt from my own book about the psychology of video games, Getting Gamers, as read by the author. Quote, psychologists Robert Knox and James Inkster once decided to visit the exhibition race park track in Vancouver, British Columbia, so that they could spend the day at the horse races. The park was near the University of British Columbia where the pair worked, but they weren't into horses or gambling. At least I don't think so. Instead, they were interested in certain people, the track's resident gamblers themselves. Knox and Inkster employed the help of over 140 racetrack patrons to test a theory they had about how placing a bet on a horse affected one's judgments. The researchers approached about half of the patrons just before they reached the front of the line for the window where one places bets on an upcoming race. The other patrons were approached just after they had made their bets. Some of the gamblers didn't speak English or told the nosy little men to get lost, but most of them happily responded to a simple question. What chances do you think the horse you are going to bet on, or have just bet on, has of winning this race? The bemused racetrack patrons were to answer the question with a scale including anchors for 1, slight, to 3, fair, to 5, good, to 7, excellent. Noxton Inkter found something in the few seconds between heading for the betting window and walking away from it had a big impact on gamblers' perceptions of how awesome their horse was. It didn't represent a gigantic change, but just the act of putting down $2 on a bet was enough to change people's opinions of the horse from fair to good. What had happened in those few seconds, of course, was that gamblers had committed themselves to a horse by placing a bet. End quote. Anyway, revisiting all this stuff about commitment as a persuasion technique made me think of a 2015 Game Developer Conference presentation about antisocial behavior in games by Ben Lewis Evans. Towards the end of the talk, Lewis Evans mentions what he calls automatic helping behaviors in multiplayer games as a potential way to combat bad behavior. These are helpful things that players don't necessarily set out to do, but which they instead do automatically in the course of playing the game. Examples include generating orbs to power up other players when you use an ability in Destiny, recharging other players' scarves in Journey by standing near them, having your character complement another player with a bark line like, "Whoa, nice shot," in Overwatch, providing in-game currency or other bonuses when you visit another player's town in a mobile city-building game, pooled money or experience point systems in MOBAs like Heroes of the Storm. I agree with Lewis Evans that these are great things for game designers to experiment with because of the consistency principle of persuasion. If we or our character do something helpful in the game, we may be more likely to want to be consistent about that kind of behavior going forward. If a game asks us if we will help other players or exhibit sportsmanship, we may be more likely to do so. If our character automatically compliments another character, we may be more likely to follow suit in voice chat or text chat. I'd love to see research testing this kind of thing. A Blizzard of Procedural Justice. In July of 2013, the game design director for Treyarch's Call of Duty Black Ops 2 tweeted what should have been some pretty innocuous stuff about changes to that game's gunplay. He tweeted, "The DSR fire time was 0.2 seconds. It's now 0.4 seconds. The rechamber time was 1.0 seconds. It's now 1.1 seconds. Certain bits of the internet then promptly flipped out and showed its ugly underbelly while wallowing in a river of toxic replies to what seemed like tiny changes. Among other things, people threatened murder and threw up all kinds of ethnic slurs. This is an example of a reaction that is thankfully extreme. And yet many of us have seen other, milder examples of players reacting poorly or out of proportion to some change to their favorite game. Some downgrade to their favorite gun or their favorite class that the game designers see as a benign change that benefits the game, but which some players see as unfair and unjust attacks. You nerfed my class slash gun slash loadout slash spell slash build slash whatever is a common enough complaint. And yet some companies manage to sidestep that kind of visceral reaction or at least dampen it somewhat. What exactly do they do that's different? To answer that, let's first consider the psychology behind concepts like justice and fairness. Such differing ideas of what constitute fair treatment given identical outcomes have long been in the interests of psychologists, particularly those studying justice in the workplace. The research started off in the 1960s by examining what people consider to be fair pay and distribution of other rewards relative to inputs like work, time, and nice bottles of scotch. Since then, though, the field has expanded to include the fairness of the process by which decisions are made, and several procedural justice rules to live by in order to create procedural justice have been discovered. Based on that research, here's one such possible list of 5 things that affect whether players see a decision to change a game as just and fair. 1. Give players a chance to voice concerns and participate in the decision-making. 2. Be consistent in your application of the changes. 3. Be transparent about why you decided to do what you did. 4. appear, and in fact be, free from bias towards or against one group of players. And finally, offer recourses for bad decisions. Given this list, let's look at how one game developer discusses changes to its game in a way that probably makes people think their decisions was more fair. Let's look, once again, at Blizzard and their competitive online shooter Overwatch. Specifically, I have a short video from November of 2016 where game designer Jeff Kaplan discusses some major changes to one of the Overwatch heroes, Symmetra. I'll include a link to the video in the post for this audio version of the article, or you can go to psychologyofgames.com and find it there. You can go ahead and go watch that now. I'll wait. It's okay. Done? Let's look at how this video and Blizzard's general approach to Overwatch changes addresses each of the rules mentioned before. Voice and participation. Kaplan notes that Symmetra update is in direct response to feedback that players had been giving them. He also notes that players can help them fine-tune the changes by testing them on the public test realm, the PTR, which is a playtesting server that anybody who owns the game can jump in on and participate in the test. At several points, Kaplan refers to the updates and refinements of the game as something that his team does with, quote, you guys. He closes the video by asking players to voice additional opinions about the changes on the official forums. Consistency. This one's a bit more subtle, but it's worth noting that the changes are consistent across the board. They're not exclusive to premium members or people who bought the more expensive Origins edition of the game. It's not included with competitive mode, but not quick play mode, and the changes will apply to everyone when it comes. If Blizzard had introduced a new character in place of the Symmetra redesign, but made it DLC, then that might have also run afoul of this rule. Transparency. Kaplan is exhaustively transparent about the reasons for the Symmetra changes. In fact, he spends the bulk of the video explaining reasons for the changes based on data and feedback from players. It's not just, we think these changes will make her better. I mean, there is that. But Kaplan also takes the time to explain how they too frequently saw Symmetra as bound to certain situations, like defending the first capture point on specific maps, and how her effectiveness dipped once the match progressed past that point. The changes to the character are then framed as solutions to this fundamental problem. Avoiding bias. This one is kind of tricky to discuss since the update is specific to one character and the people who like to play her. But when you step back and look at the developer updates across the board and read individual patch notes, it becomes clear that Blizzard takes the wide-angle view of their game and considers how changes to one hero affect the entire game. They consider the impact of one change and what it has on other heroes, and they communicate that in their communications with players. To illustrate, Kaplan spends some time in the Symmetra video discussing how her new ability, Photon Barrier, can benefit other heroes. He also specifically invites non-Symmetra players to share feedback about how playing against the new changes feels on the PTR, so that their feedback can be taken into account before the changes are made final, offering remedies for bad decisions. Of the five rules, this is probably the least relevant to the topic of nerfing and other balance changes in games. In the world of work, offering remedies would include letting people appeal a decision to an oversight board or a complaint to a government agency like the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission here in the United States. But what Blizzard does here is promise to look at the win rate data collected from people playtesting the changes and make adjustments before they are introduced to the full game. And they have a history of publicly undoing or reducing changes if they don't play out like everyone thought they would. So there you have it, five reasons why I admire how the Overwatch team at Blizzard is handling changes to their game. Undoubtedly, there's still players who vociferously object to these changes and claim that they're unfair, but I suspect it's many fewer than it would be if Kaplan and his team weren't so upfront and deliberate about how they explain the procedures they went through to arrive at their decisions. It takes time, but it's generally worth it.
Justice reigns from above!
Why being a better gamer can help you be a better person. Hey, you suck at math and your shoes are stupid. How'd that make you feel? I know, probably didn't have much of a bite coming from some random goof like me on the internet, but maybe you're not even wearing shoes right now. But if the criticisms came from a more credible source, like a test of your math skills or a shoe test, it would sting more. And what's more, in order to preserve your positive image of yourself in your own head, you're more likely to act defensively by dismissing the results of the math test, or at the very least, you would be more open to suggestions that the test was flawed. This is especially true if you consider being good at math as an important part of your identity. Such shielding of our precious self-image can be counterproductive in a lot of cases. If you aim to get better grades in that math class or a better performance review at work, then you're best served by understanding your flaws and figuring out how to improve on them. Avoiding and discrediting valid feedback is a bad idea in such case. How can we best resist this mental rut and improve ourselves? How, oh how, you all, good news, video games can help. Sometimes it feels good to win and to feel like you're mastering a challenging game. It's nice to win a round in an online shooter or develop a winning character build in a role-playing game. It feels good to beat a boss or top your friend's best time on a racetrack. And such successes are more likely in video games than in real life because games are specifically designed to let you learn, develop, and excel. This fact ties back in with math tests and performance reviews because of something called self-affirmation theory. This theory predicts what I described above about ignoring negative but useful feedback that's damaging to important self-concepts, but it also suggests that a good way to get people to avoid this mental trap is to give them feedback about some other unrelated thing that bolsters their self-image. So if you find out that you got a bad score in a math test, you may not discredit that feedback if you're also told that you're very likable. Or maybe you're told that you're good at video games. That idea, that feeling good at video games can inoculate people against the pitfalls of self-affirmation theory, was recently tested by a study appearing in the Journal of Cyberpsychology, Behavior, and Social Networking. In it, researchers had subjects take what the subjects thought was a general intelligence test. Then, because all psychology researchers are pathological liars, they gave some subjects bogus feedback. Specifically, they told them that they did horribly on the test and that they would be surprised if the subject could figure out how to pour water from a boot if the instructions were written on the heel. Then the researchers had the subjects play a custom-made first-person shooter that was said to be a, quote, valid assessment of video game skills. Then, some subjects got feedback on the game saying that they were super awesome at it and that they had amazing skills. What the researchers found was that for subjects who thought of themselves as gamers and for whom doing well in a game was a part of their identity, the results of the intelligence tests were less harmful, but also not ignored. They accepted what, in the absence of all the lies, would have been accurate feedback about their performance on the intelligence test. If they had been so inclined and given the opportunity, they would have been more motivated to work towards improving themselves in that area. The researchers sum it up by saying, quote, "The research suggests that players who value video game success as part of their identity can use positive video game feedback as a buffer against threatening negative test scores and thereby allow players to internalize such information." So the next time you're waiting on the results of a test, a job application, or some other feedback about something near and dear to you, consider some preemptive soothing balm in the form of crushing some scrubs or completing a quest in your favorite game. Hey, podcast listeners, thanks for listening. Thanks for getting through the entirety of this very special episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. There's always new content, new articles to see and hear over at psychologyofgames.com. I'll have new podcasts coming in 2018, as well as lots of great new articles. You can always go over to psychologyofgames.com to find out how to follow me on social media like Facebook and Twitter, and how you can also find out how to support me on patreon.com/POG. Thanks, and I will see you next episode.